One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Don't the treasure.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute. It's just a few weeks since a group of neo-Nazis burned a cross in the Grampians in Victoria.
Yelling white pride, chanting Ku Klux Klan and giving Hail Hitler salutes while at the popular tourist spot.
Just a few months since the head of ASIO warned that far-right violent extremism now constitutes up to 40% of the domestic spy agency's counter-terrorism caseload. That's up from 10 to 15% before 2016.
In Australia, the right-wing extremist threat is real and it is growing. In suburbs around Australia, small cells meet regularly, salute Nazi flags, inspect weapons, train in combat and share their hateful ideology.
And it's not even 2 years since a white Australian terrorist murdered 51 people and injured 40 others at the Al Noor Mosque and the Linwood Islamic Centre in Christchurch, New Zealand.
We haven't even had a proper conversation about the extent to which Brenton Tarrant was radicalised here in Australia by the right-wing extremist groups in this country.
The rise of right-wing extremism is happening all around us, yet it does not dominate Australia's national security discourse in the way that Islamic extremism did in the years after 9/11.
The major threat still comes from that radical Islamic extremist element within the Australian society, but they're worried about the right-wing extreme element as well. But ASIO doesn't discriminate on the basis of whether they're at the far left or the far right.
So to help us unpack the nature of the problem facing us today, we're delighted to bring you Dr. Anne Alley, the MP for Cowan, who is a guest on our webinar series, and the topic was the rise of right-wing extremism. Prior to entering Parliament, Dr. Alley was a professor at Curtin University and Edith Cowan University, leading world-renowned research into counter-terrorism and countering violent extremism. She has published over 100 articles and books on the subject and is the founding chair of People Against Violent Extremism, a not-for-profit organisation focused on empowering communities to challenge violent extremism. Dr. Alley was in conversation with Richard Dennis, our chief economist. This was recorded live on Wednesday, the 10th of February, 2021, and things may have changed since recording.
So I wanted to start really with kind of the more recent events. It was only towards the end of last year that we saw the head of ASIO making that comment that about 40% of its workload is now right-wing extremism, and that's up from about 10 to 15% a few years ago. What did you think when you heard that stat?
I wasn't surprised, at all. In fact, I think that the focus should have been on a rise in right-wing extremism much earlier. I would say as early as 2009, even before then. So I wasn't surprised that that was the workload. I guess I was the element of surprise in that was that they are finally focusing on the right wing. Throughout my career, at least, raising a rising right-wing extremism has been particularly frustrating. It's often been kind of relegated to the political fringes, to a disorganised, disoriented kind of group. But the nature of contemporary terrorism is that it's not organised through a hierarchical base or Al-Qaeda type movement, that it is very diffuse, that it is about individuals who are loosely affiliated to organisations and to movements and who are inspired by other individuals and other what they perceive to be successful terrorist attacks. So I think that the focus on right wing was really essential if we're going to keep up with modern trends in terrorism.
And so just before we get kind of too much more into it, for people who are unfamiliar with the topic, What do we mean by right-wing extremism?
That's a really good question, because it is a very, very broad umbrella term. And the fact that it is a broad umbrella term, I think, actually makes it quite difficult to pinpoint what we're talking about. But it also makes it difficult to really focus in on what we're actually trying to target, because you have people who associate themselves with being conservative or the right wing going, well, that's not me. And mainstream ideas, mainstream values that are considered to be right wing, and people who adhere to those values or identify with those values find it incredibly difficult to understand what right wing extremism is. But it is very much an umbrella term that encompasses a whole lot of and a broad range of beliefs and movements that are associated more with far right political and social ideologies. And so within that broad category of right wing terrorism sits white nationalism, neo-Nazism, eco-fascism, which is not to do with the environment, white separatism, ethnocentrism, patriot militia movements. Some scholars would also include Christian identity movements in there, anti-abortion extremism in there. And others argue that really when we talk about right-wing extremism, we differentiate between racist extremism and anti-government extremism. At its core, right-wing extremism or far-right extremism is all about anti-authoritarianism. There's an Aryan kind of white supremacist element in there. Some groups also are satanic. So the Order of Nine Angles, for example, is also satanic. And there's also within that misogynism and the incel, the involuntary celibate movement.
Mm.
So it's very, very broad and encompasses a whole range.
Yeah, that's certainly a lot to unpack. And just when we were kind of catching up before this webinar started, you were saying that Australia's actually got a really long history with right-wing extremism. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I might take you through that history quite quickly, though. You know, we'll have a quick thing. So even though we've had this kind of focus over the past couple of years, Australia does have a very long history. And if we go back to the 1920s and 30s was when organised forms of right-wing terrorism really took hold in Australia. And they were mainly anti-communist and anti-unionist. They were also, in the 30s, they became fascists, national socialists, highly, highly anti-Semitic, and highly driven by Aryan ideals. In the 1940s, they then veered more towards patriotism and the idea or the ideal of a white Australia vision. And they had something called the Australia First Movement. They adhered to a very strong anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. So we had a lot of stuff coming out in Australia, published in Australia, that was anti-Semitic. In the 60s and 70s, it was constant in Australia, though it remained kind of on the political fringes. In the 1980s, we had a surge in it, and that was mainly due to the Australian Nationalist Movement and National Action that were involved in attacks in Sydney, but also Jack Van Tongeren, who led National Action in Sydney, ran under that banner for the Senate in 1984, in the 1984 election. He got 1,077 votes for that. Didn't get in, thankfully. The Australian Nationalist Movement in the late 1980s in Perth, prior to that, was mainly involved in poster campaigns, anti-Asian propaganda, but in the late 1980s turned to violence, and there was a campaign of firebombing Chinese and Asian businesses. In the late 1990, Jack Van Tongeren, who was the leader, was arrested in connection with the murder of another ANM member who was suspected of being a police informant. After his release, he again ran under the Australian Nationalist Workers Union, ran for parliament. One of the most interesting stories that I've come across, though, is I don't know if any of your listeners here are familiar with David Lane. David Lane is considered one of the most significant ideologues in the right-wing movement. He was an American who died in 2007 in federal prison, where he was serving a 190-year sentence for racketeering, conspiracy, and violating the civil rights of a radio talk show host called Alan Berg, who was murdered in his driveway by Lane. Lane was the head of a group called The Order. It was listed as a terrorist organisation. He had also been involved in the Ku Klux Klan, but he's most known for coining the 14 words. And if you have a look at terrorist right-wing symbolism and some of the insignias that they have, 14 and 88 are two numbers that crop up. And the 14 in that refers to the 14 words coined by David Lane: we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Now, in 2007, after he died, there was an idea that his ashes would be buried in a white homeland, and the Aryan women tried to raise money to build a shrine, but they didn't get enough money to build a shrine. So his ashes were separated into 14 little kind of pyramids and sent around the world to different countries. One of those countries is Australia.
Wow. And
it blow your mind to think that right here in Perth, where I'm coming to you from, there is a shrine to David Lane, one of the fathers of the modern white supremacist right-wing extremism movement right here in Perth. So the story goes that, and for all intents and purposes, I believe this story to be true, they shipped over one of the vials of his ashes. There was a big commemoration service in Perth. Those ashes still are here in Perth. And there are regular gatherings of white supremacists who come to pay their respects to David Lane on an annual or more than annual basis here in Perth. So that shows you the extent to which it has been in Australia. 2016, we had the arrest of Philip Galea. Probably the first arrest of a kind of more of a right-wing terrorist under Australia's pretty broad suite of terrorism laws. Prior to that, there had not been really an arrest of right-wing terrorists for terrorism charges. Even Jack Van Tongeren wasn't charged with terrorism. Two members of Combat 18 who shot a Perth mosque here were not arrested for terrorism. And if I could just go through the groups that have been kind of around in Australia, particularly over the last decade, and this is just touching the tip of the iceberg. We've got Southern Cross, Hammerskins, Blood and Honour, Combat 18, Women of the Southern Legion, Aryan Nations, Aryan Strike Force, Australian Defence League, Right Wing Resistance, Reclaim Australia, the United Patriots Front, True Blue Crew, Antipodean Resistance, Proud Boys, Lad Society, the Soldiers of Odin, the Ku Klux Klan, the Australian Nationalist Alternative, Identity Australia, the Australian Liberty Alliance, New National Action, the Patriotic Youth League, the Base, the Order of Nine Angles, which is a neo-Nazi satanic group affiliated with the Adam Orphan Division, which has been proscribed in other Western countries. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of the number of have been or are currently active.
So while extremism is definitely, right-wing extremism is definitely on the rise, there's a very long history in Australia that goes back many years there. Richard, did you want to chime in with a question there?
Yeah, look, so thanks, Anne. It's fascinating and, you know, it's so incredibly diverse. And I guess we when we talk about right-wing extremism, you know, perhaps we're uniting them perhaps more than they unite themselves. They clearly like to set up lots of little groups. But I guess what is the difference between people holding extremist views, like, you know, they're convinced that white people are genuinely special and acting on those views in terms of extreme behavior. Like, is there always a link between the two, or are there a lot of people out there with what might seem extreme views that they don't act on? And how, in a democracy with free speech, do we kind of juggle that? Are we? It's obvious that we like to outlaw behaviours that are dangerous and offensive, but is it the views themselves that are dangerous? How do we kind of grapple with that?
It's such a fascinating question, because it's not just a question for the right wing. I mean, this was a question that we grappled with other forms of terrorism as well. What's the difference between holding views and acting on those views? So you can still be a radical and an extremist without being a violent radical or a violent extremism. There's been a lot of work done about what is that tipping point from ideology and from belief to actual action. There's not a lot of clarity on that, because the fact is that each individual's trajectory to violence can be quite different from another individual's trajectory to violence. The fact also is that there are a lot of people who hold fairly extremist views, who believe in conspiracy theories, but never actually act on those views and what that tipping point might be. One of the clues that we could have to that is there have been a number of typologies of different terrorist actors that kind of tries to look at any kind of patterns of behavior or any kind of patterns of indicators. And one of the most interesting that I've come across in terms of the far right has been Willem's study of the social and biographical characteristics of perpetrators of far right xenophobic violence in Germany. And he looked at the process of escalation. His study was particularly interesting because he kind of extracted four different kinds of people or individuals who would be attracted to the far right, or who have been attracted to the far right and who have acted on that. And importantly, he differs them based on their political ideological orientation and their propensity to violence, right? So he's got the four categories that he have are right-wing activists, ethnocentric youth, criminal youth, and fellow travellers. They're his four types of actors. Of those four types, three of them have a history of criminal activity. Right, so right-wing activists had prior records for political crimes. Ethnocentric youth had prior records for juvenile crime. Criminal youth had multiple records of criminal activity. So what his model suggests is that some people will be attracted by the ideology, and it will be the ideology that fuels them to undertake violence, because a core part of the ideology is that we're under threat, you're part of my group is under threat, the only way to deal with this threat is to take up arms, right? So there are some people who will be drawn to the ideology and then come to violence via the ideology, but there are others who will be drawn to the violence with very little or no connection to the ideology. And in fact, fellow travellers are mostly attracted by the symbolism. So you see them, the kind of the skinheads. They'll have the tattoos, they'll wear the clothing that identifies them with this subculture of skinheads. And that's what attracts them to the movement. Now, it's no different than the kinds of research, what research was revealing about young people who go and join ISIS, for example, that some of them were driven by the ideology, others were driven by the violence, and a kind of almost a sense of adventure as well. So I guess the answer to your question is we don't have a clear idea of what that tipping point is from belief to violence, but we do know that the two don't always go hand in hand. that you can have belief and not become violent, and you can have violence without a deep psychological identification with the ideology.
Mm. And does social media make it easier for these groups to form, or does it make it easier for us as citizens and our intelligence community to actually find them? Like, is social media, is it helping or harming?
Oh, a bit of both, actually, you know. So, like, so social media really operates as more of an echo chamber. So, the kinds of likes and habits that people in the right wing or far right share are usually very blatant on their social media. They'll like things like Norse mythology, for example, Odinism. They're into all of that kind of stuff. And so it serves as an echo chamber, because one of the purposes of media generally is that it serves a social identity need in each of us as individuals. And that's the kind of need that social media like Facebook fulfills. It gives you a social identity. But more and more, they're moving more towards the dark spaces of the internet, where there isn't that kind of overtness. So, for example, gaming platforms like Discord have become very prolific and useful, I guess, recruitment platforms for some groups that are operating, and they'll use this chat function within the gaming platforms to connect with young people, influence them, recruit them, radicalize them. So social media does play a part. On the other side, as you say, I've used social media and developed social media tools for identifying people who would be candidates for some kind of intervention. And it can be very, very handy in identifying people who are candidates for early intervention. We did a project where we actually had a group of former right wing, former jihadists, violent jihadists, former political terrorists or actors as well, find people on Facebook who they knew through their Facebook profiles, through their social media profiles, were getting involved in and becoming immersed in the ideology of a particular extremist worldview, and contact them. So at the same time, it can be a very powerful tool for identifying people for early intervention. The issue is, where do you draw the line? Where's the balance?
Yeah. I did note that the New Zealand Royal Commission into the Christchurch massacre really showed that perpetrator was radicalised through Facebook and YouTube primarily, which is, you know, we all think of those as being quite benign, but actually, you know, they seem to have played a big role there. But coming to Christchurch, it seemed to me that there was no real reckoning in Australia with the fact that that was an Australian terrorist. And it kind of really dropped out of the national discourse quite quickly. Do you think we've really reckoned with the fact that terrorist was born and bred in and radicalized in Australia? And are we doing enough? We've talked about ASIO, but it seems to me there's not really a big national discourse around this type of problem and what we're going to do to tackle it.
No, you're absolutely right, Ebony. I think we haven't reckoned with the fact that he was Australian. I mean, you know, the whole, oh, he's not one of us, he's not one of us. But let's be honest and frank that when it is a violent jihadist, Muslim communities were asked to own that individual, to say, oh, he is one of us and we need to reckon with that. Now, I get it, because we've been in that situation. I'm, as a member of Muslim communities, I've been in that situation where you have to go, oh, my gosh, and turn the mirror on yourself. It's an incredibly difficult thing to do. It is incredibly difficult to turn the mirror on yourself and say, could he be one of us? Could there be something that we have done, something in our values, in the way that we communicate those values that could have contributed to this. I don't think we've gotten to that point here in Australia. In terms of what could be done, what I find really interesting, in terrorism studies, we talk about something called domino theory. And domino theory means that one attack or one individual who's perceived to be successful, and successful meaning able to carry out a successful attack, inspires other attacks, right? So the Christchurch terrorist inspired no less than 13 other attacks in the US. And what I've been noticing, I've had to do more research on this, but from a kind of like at a kind of a first look kind of level, domino theory seems to be a lot more prominent with the far right than it has with, for example, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, who had a very hierarchical structure where there was, you know, one leader, whereas with far right groups, it's all kind of, it's more individual based. It's more, based on manifestos, and the manifestos are used to inspire further attacks. Now, what New Zealand has done is actually prescribed the terrorist attacker himself as a terrorist entity, which I think is a very smart move. And I think a move that kind of gets ahead of trends in terrorism. I think often in counterterrorism, we're behind the trend, and we're always playing catch-ups. And I think I mentioned earlier that the trend in terrorism now is more diffuse. It's more about inspiring. It's more lone actors who watch something on YouTube, who have all of this, have all of these kinds of grievances, and then are inspired to act by somebody else who has acted. That kind of domino theory. And so I think the idea of prescribing individuals as terrorist entities, as what New Zealand has done, is a really intelligent way of dealing with this new trend, or what seems to be, it's not new, but what seems to be the more kind of prolific trend with right-wing terrorism than it has been with the forms of terrorism that we've been dealing with predominantly over the past two decades or so.
That makes me ask as well, sorry, Richard, I can come back to you if you had another question there. I thought it was really interesting that right from the get-go, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern just refused to speak his name and really took that approach of not trying to glorify that perpetrator. And it makes me think about how media reports on these types of issues, and there's often critiques from people of colour about platforming neo-Nazis, for example, or from the other side, the media kind of talking about, well, we have to get both sides of the story type of thing. What are the things that media needs to think about in terms of responsibly reporting on right-wing extremism, considering that inspiration is one of the main objectives?
I think one of the first, I mean, you know, we have a history in the Australian media with, stereotyping. Australian media, if we go back, way back to the 1800s, before we had like mainstream media, the popular novel in Australia was the invasion narrative, which was like, you know, oh, we're going to be swamped by Asians. And so throughout history, our media has kind of been complicit in this idea that, you know, we're in Asia, but we're not Asian, and that we're going to be swamped by hordes of people flooding our shores. And they've done it in like tacit ways, you know, with stereotypes and so on. So there's a primed audience for this kind of stuff here in Australia, and it's been primed that way over decades and decades of mainstream media building and building and building this kind of mainstreaming and normalizing a certain level of xenophobia in Australia. In terms of reporting attacks, you know, I often hear when there is an attack, it's often called the gunman, you know, instead of the terrorists. So there's a lot to be said about naming, yeah, naming them as terrorists, labeling them as terrorists. And I think a lot of it comes out, I hear it a lot from people in Muslim communities who see a double standard when it comes to reporting about acts of violence that have been perpetrated by violent jihadists versus acts of violence that have been perpetrated by white supremacists or the far right. There is not a consistent standard in reporting in our media. I think that's a really good place to start. Mm. I think also giving more attention to it is a really good place to start. But underlying all of that is coming back to this whole idea of let's turn the mirror on ourselves, yeah, and let's have a look at what it is in terms of what we espouse as values in our history, in our the dark parts of our history that is now kind of giving rise to and has for many years normalized some of these values and some of these ideals that are being adopted by violent movements.
We might go now to questions from the audience. We've got about 1,200 people on the line with us today, so we're not going to get to everyone's questions, I'm sorry, but thank you so much again for joining us. The first question I'm going to ask is from Christine Aegis. She says, Anne, to what extent do you see far-right ideas and discourses in mainstream politics? Would you say these ideas have become appropriated or used by politicians more so recently?
Thank you, Irene. Irene, was it?
Christine.
Christine, sorry. Yes, definitely they are in our political discourse, and they have been for a long time. As I've said, you know, the Australian Nationalist Movement tried to gain a Senate seat. You know, Pauline Hanson, Fraser Anning, these are people who stood in our parliament and talked about Asian invasion. These are people who stood in our parliament and espoused the very ideals that people in these far-right groups are core to their belief system. I think also the far-right operates in a way, and they operate in a way in which they utilise these kind of mainstream ideas of patriotism, nationalism, and use them in ways to further their cause. Again, not different to any other terrorist movement. Yeah. Violent jihadists did the same thing. They used religion to as a vehicle to mobilize their cause, right? And these guys use these values of patriotism, these values of nationalism, these values of national pride to mobilise their cause as well. So you have your average mum and dad who sit there and go, well, what's wrong with being proud of your country? What's wrong with being a patriot? Because it has become so normalised, because they're using those mainstream ideas to capture the attention of a wider population. And yes, it has been in our political discourse for some time now. And it's not just those fringe groups. It's not just those smaller political parties. There are members of larger political parties who also espouse some of those views. I mean, you only have to look at Alex Hawke denying the advice that came from our security agencies with regard to the right wing being an increasing threat in Australia. It should not be political.
Mm. If I recall, Peter Dutton immediately equated right-wing extremism with left-wing.
Exactly. It should not be political. And though it's called right-wing, really in its essence, it's not about left and right politics. It's not about left and right politics, because the right-wing are anti-authoritarian. Right. So they don't want you either. So, you know, we really need to get over this. Oh, you're in the left, so you support this, or you're in the right, you support that. It really needs to be bipartisan in its approach. And unfortunately, we're coming up against a few challenges in that regard.
Mm. The next question is from Denise Travell. She asks, what makes people vulnerable to these groups and ideologies, and what's the attraction? And do they seem to gather pace during times of uncertainty? Which reminds me, actually, the siege of the US Capitol, that seemed to be just very disparate groups. You know, you QAnon conspiracy theorists, the Proud Boys, white supremacists. There was like lots of different people in there. Could you, just comment on what attracts these people, going back to perhaps those ideologies you were talking about or typologies earlier?
Yeah, so I'll answer that question by going through the ways in which all terrorist movements construct themselves. And they do that by constructing themselves as a movement that is responding to some kind of existential threat, either a real threat or a perceived threat. The terroristic propaganda has some consistencies regardless of where it comes from. And those consistencies can be found in four elements. The first one is orientation. And that is within the right, far right, it's about the condition of the white races. It's about reclaiming white nationalism. Then comes the problem. The problem is that society is degenerating because of lefties, because of Muslims, because of Jews, because of multiculturalism, because of homosexuality, etc. And that's fueled, of course, by the Great Replacement Conspiracy, which is a theory that the white races are being overtaken, if you like, by multiculturalism. The third part is the solution. And the solution is, according to them, to restore the white races and the superiority of the white race. And then the fourth part is the required course of action, which is violence, bringing about a race war, anarchy, basically anti-authoritarian, bringing down the authoritarian institutions that are part of this conspiracy to replace the white races. Now, what attracts people to that is that young people in particular have very strong personal identity needs, right? And they become particularly vulnerable to influence because they have a need to form social bonds and to define their identity as members of a group. Right? We all did it. I remember when I was a teenager, I identified with particular kinds of music and defined my identity through those kinds of music. Violent extremists exploit that need. They exploit that need for belonging. They exploit that need for identity. So young people in particular, again, I'm coming to young people who have a grievance. If they feel angry, they feel that they're a victim of injustice. That might be, we've seen in a time of a global pandemic, people are searching for something, you know, they believe that they're getting the raw end of the deal, if you like. They become drawn to those messages because those messages emphasize in-group and out-group relations. They say, you're part of us, you're one of us. And as part of us, if there's an us, there's a them. And that them wants to destroy us. So I'm going to give you a purpose in your life, and your purpose in life is to protect us, to be a part of this group and to protect us. So yeah, that's, I guess, kind of the social psychological part of it. But of course, there are a whole lot of other things like global events play into it, individual contexts, social contexts all come into it as well. I think that was there another part of that question that I missed?
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you, Anne. The next question is from David Everett, who... we accidentally moved this one into answered questions, but we hadn't yet. You've kind of touched on it. He says, is it useful to try and describe extremism as either right or left? And why not just brand all extremism as dangerous?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the thing is, not all extremism is dangerous. Right? There's a theory out there that there are extremist movements that are violent, and there are those who are not yet violent, but eventually they all become violent. I don't know that there's enough empirical evidence to support that all extremist groups become violent. I think it is useful to name the groups because, or the I guess the mode or the what David Rappaport would call the wave of terrorism. I mean, he describes, you know, different waves of terrorism that have been precipitated by global events, the anarchist wave, the new left wave, oh gosh, I can't remember them all, but the last one is the religious wave, and each wave lasts about 40 years. So I think it's useful in terms of being able to pinpoint who we're talking about instead of just all extremists, because all extremism isn't dangerous. That's the fact. Some forms of extremism, and if we're going to be bold about this, the fact is that some forms of extremism and radicalism have become essential to paradigm shifts in society, to changing the ways in which society looks at itself and the values that society has in positive ways, right? Not in negative ways, but in positive ways. So I think it is important that we identify the kind of extremism it is, because on a practical level, it helps us to identify the individuals and the groups that we should be targeting. And I think our counterterrorism efforts are assisted by that.
The next two questions I'm going to put together, because I think they're linked even though they're different. So Peter Havord has asked, what can state and federal governments do to mitigate the radicalising impacts of growing right-wing extremism? Actually, he's specified in the traditional media in Australia. But Mark Diesendorf has asked, under the guise of protecting against terrorism, the Australian government has passed legislation that some believe is undermining basic human rights and democracy, for example, being able to arrest people without allowing them to inform their families. So both questions about what federal governments have done. I think one asking, have they gone too far? And one asking, have we not gone far enough?
They're both, you're right, they're both very interconnected. And I often observe that Australia has the broadest and most comprehensive suite of laws related to terrorism or terrorism-related offences, more than any other Western country, more than any other Western country, more than Canada, more than the US, more than the UK, even though we have not had a mass casualty attack on our soil. We have the broadest suite and the most far-reaching and far-ranging terrorism laws of any Western country. And the reason for that is because traditionally the way that we've dealt with terrorism has been with a legislative response. And so it kind of grew into this thing that we have layers and layers and layers and layers and layers and layers of laws to deal with terrorism. What we haven't done equally comprehensively has been to really look at how terrorism, extremism, violent extremism in all its forms is a battle for hearts and minds. Okay? And laws don't change hearts and minds. If that was the case, laws that against murder means there would be no murders, right? Laws don't change behaviour. Laws don't change hearts and minds. So we've kind of neglected this aspect, which I think is a central and should be a centrepiece of our counterterrorism efforts. We've left that part to civil society, and a civil society that has not been well equipped with dealing with forms of extremism in the way that civil society in parts of Europe have been really well equipped with dealing with forms of terrorism. I mean, in Europe, you have the Radicalization Awareness Network, which is huge, hugely funded, and this huge network across all different European countries to deal with radicalization. You have, and you have had for many years, civil society groups that have been funded and are very well equipped to deal with different forms of extremism. But we haven't had that in Australia. And we still don't have that in Australia. It was part of the reason that I started PAVE, was to develop civil society capacity to deal with these early intervention in extremism, the prevention side of it. And I think as part of that, that's where we can do the media work as well, just coming back to the question. So the answer is we've had so much focus on the legislative response and not a balanced focus on the civil society response. And I think, and I've been advocating for, much more focus on developing civil society structures and civil society capabilities to deal with early intervention and prevention.
Mm. Richard, we've got 10 minutes left. Did you have any other questions before I finish up with the Q&A from the public?
Yeah, look, I guess, you know, so many of the things you've said, and particularly in terms of how New Zealand responded and, as you said, kind of tried to get ahead, I guess it makes me think about a meta question, and that is, I mean, experts, you know, I'm an economist, I get frustrated by the economics debate. You know, medical scientists get frustrated by debates about how to deal with an epidemic. Makes me realize it must be excruciatingly difficult to have expertise in counterterrorism and extremism, because I wonder what your perception is of where policymakers in Australia have got their expertise from. I mean, people in the military didn't learn how to deal with terrorism 20 or 30 years ago. They learned how to fight conventional wars. People in counterterrorism have got really quite different skills, you know, from the kind of Hearts and Minds campaign you're talking about. So, you know, as a country, not just Australia, as any country, how do we go about actually having some evidence basis for dealing with something both as rare but as shocking as acts of terrorism? Because, as you said, I mean, we've obviously responded by having you know, some of the toughest anti-terrorism laws in the world, arguably toughest breaches of civil liberties. But where do we get the evidence based from? Where do people like yourself sort of see this debate evolving to? Or has everyone got an idea of a terrorist from watching a movie and thinks they're an expert?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. You know, like that's what... Pretty much. The thing... 9/11 brought terrorism to our screens. Now, terrorism was on our screens before that as well, in the 1970s, when you had the kind of rise of international terrorism, airplane hijackings and whatever. But you think about 9/11, and the world witnessed in real time, through the magic of television, witnessed a major terrorist event. And the thing about putting people in the position of witness is you kind of almost put them in the position of expert as well. If I can't tell you how many people have told me I'm wrong and my evidence is wrong and my 10 years of research is wrong because they saw it on TV. Hmm? So people do, and you know, that's what the kind of the new media ecology has done as well. It's given people the tools to develop their own kind of knowledge and expertise, but, you know, it's not that clear cut. You're very right in saying we approach counterterrorism in a very traditional way. And the wisdom of employing a traditional military response to terrorism has rightly been questioned, because what we find is that you can't bomb terrorism out of people's minds. You can't arrest it out of their hearts. You can't do these things. So that shift is necessary. In terms of the level of expertise that we have in Australia, I think we need to build that level of expertise. We have a really great generation of young people coming up who are studying counterterrorism, who are developing some expertise in it. We still lack expertise in the cyber elements of it, and cyber-enabled terrorism in particular, where digital technologies are used to do everything from influence, recruit, raise funds for acts of terrorism. I think we need a lot more international cooperation. This is not an issue that Australia is facing on its own. And so that's something that I've been really frustrated with, the lack of kind of international cooperation, working with countries in Europe that have a long history of dealing with as I mentioned earlier, you know, civil society structures and dealing with prevention of terrorism, particularly in the far-right space, working with our nearest neighbours, Indonesia and Malaysia and countries like that. So I think we do need to develop the professional base in terms of developing an evidence base. Obviously, it's difficult to interview convicted terrorists for a number of reasons. Sometimes also, you know, because they're dead. So it's not just difficult, it's impossible. but there's a lot we can learn by talking to formers, to people who have left terrorism behind. And there's some great work that's done in the US on why people leave terrorism behind. One of the things that I always say is I've interviewed about 20 former terrorists as part of a project that I was doing. One of the things I always say is nobody ever left terrorism because somebody presented them with a fact sheet. Never. There's always an emotional connection, right? There's always a seed of doubt that's been planted, and then almost a kind of an epiphany of some sort that happens to move people away, make them question their involvement in the movement and move people away from that. I don't know if I've answered your question, Richard, but other than to say, yes, absolutely, I agree. We need more expertise in Australia. We need a bigger evidence base, but we're not going to get that working solely among ourselves. We need to work more internationally with that. And most of the research that I did was international because there was no empirical base, evidence base that I could draw on in Australia. And that, you know, developing that expertise and developing that professionalism needs to be also part of that, is that development of civil society structures to be able to deal with it.
Well, it's all right. I mean, anyone that's ever run a business knows how to run the entire economy. So it's not like there's any overconfidence in the Australian policy.
You should say, I have to read you one day some of the emails that I get from the experts. Oh, Anne Ali, you know nothing. I know everything.
So we've only got a couple of minutes and we do like to finish on time. So just very quickly, and there's two questions here, one from Christine and I think one from Narelle Wilson, both asking about the role of gender in right-wing extremism and is there any overlap in ideologies? Christine says, our research seems to suggest that there's some overlap between the far-right and anti-feminist groups online in Victoria. Do you want to comment on that? We've only got a couple of minutes to go.
Yes. And certainly misogyny is part of that right-wing extremism umbrella. Attackers in the US in particular have also had like kind of anti-feminist views. And you add into like all of the anti things that they are, all of the things they hate, feminism is also one of the things they hate as well. So there is that in terms of the kind of the gender nuances as well. There are women for Aryan causes as well. So there are some pretty active women's only groups. And let's not forget Prussia Blue, the two young twin girls who were, you know, pop stars basically with the white supremacists as well. So there's definitely a gendered element in it. I don't think we have enough data and we don't have enough research on the gendered element in it. And I'd like to see more. I'd like to see more about that gendered element. So if you guys are doing research, I'd love to hear about it.
Thanks, Anne. And anything that you want to say to wrap up, and then I'll wrap us all up. That's all we've got time for.
No, only to say thank you very much. It's great to see some familiar names coming up on the chat. Hello, Jill. Hello. And a few other people that I've recognised their names as well. That's it. Thank you very much.
No worries. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate having your expertise. And I want to thank everyone who's been online today. My colleagues tell me everyone kept it pretty civil in the chat. So we really appreciate it. Thank you to Dr. Anne Ali. Thank you to Richard Dennis. And thank you all for all your excellent questions.
This has been a special episode of Follow the Money. All our webinars are free and available on the Australia Institute's YouTube channel. All our latest research and content is at australiainstitute.org.au. And we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. And Richard Dennis is at RDNS_TAI. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. Remember, stay safe out there, and thanks for listening.